Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th, and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
So, the renew of virtue ethics, and try to introduce some of the adventure of this rediscovery. But one of the questions that should have been in your mind from this morning is, how did we get into this fix? I began by saying that the two types of freedom were recurring realities in the history of the West. And that is true. The question is, how did one version become dominant? And now that would take us, we'd have to go back into the early Middle Ages, and we'd have to see how certain ideas became dominant. But something I want to get you thinking about it is, if you went through a period of kind of youthful Christian exuberance about the natural world. So if you look at Romanesque architecture, there is a celebration of all of the imaginary creatures that you've heard about from reading texts that you've gotten from the East, and there are griffins and all these things. The natural world is like a playground for grace. But then a few things start to happen. The first one is the Great Famine. Difficult for us to understand, but the Great Famine back in the 11th century, actually no, it's late, it's 12th, starts to traumatize people. You have events in the 13th and 14th century that start to traumatize people's confidence that the natural world is a place that is concerned about them and positive and good. So by the time you get to someone like Duns Scotus, who is a venerable and holy man, and he's the one who articulated our theology of the Immaculate Conception, he's much more reticent to say anything definitive about our animality. Our animality has become a problem for him, and specifically the idea that you could ever have virtues that habituate your passions for good. So, as you begin to doubt your relationship to the natural world, and as you begin to doubt God's activity in the natural world, your confidence that you can know anything, that things have natures that you can know, begins to dissolve. And you know that God is all-powerful, you know that he's all-good, you know that he has a will for you and for the salvation. So as you begin to lose confidence in what you can know, in faith you start to focus on what God wills for you. So for example, Scotus, he's going to say that the moral life, all the virtues are virtues of the will, so that the emotional life is like a storm, and you never know when the storm is going to come up or go down, and your job is just to keep course. Now that's a very legitimate, you can understand why you would develop that. If you begin to doubt whether you can know very much about human nature as human nature, and as you begin to doubt that you can ever really train your emotions to respond the way they should, simply maintaining course, you know, holding on to the tiller and maintaining course no matter what storm is attacking you, that sounds reasonable and is still influential. That is a legitimate Catholic vision. But it's linked to a lot of other things that start to emerge. A lack of confidence in our knowledge of the natural world. And there are radical versions of this that start to emerge that have their roots in the 14th century that by the Protestant Reformation are going to explode onto the life of the church. And not only that, there will be lay movements that also are in Catholic countries, perhaps under the influence of the French Protestants, it's hard to tell, but that also caused the church leadership to have real concerns. Quietism, Jansenism, you just go down the list of isms that begin to concern the church. So the church finally gets its act together. The saints have been calling the hierarchy of the church to have a council and to reform the church, and it leads to the Reformation because the church didn't do this. And so there's a desire to kind of put a lid on the excesses of voluntarism and nominalism. And we can say that the theology of the Baroque. Now the Baroque, anyone study Baroque music? When does the Baroque start musically? When does the Baroque start architecturally?
Enter Reformation.
That's good, but what dates are we talking about?
It's the
1700s.
1700s.
Well, it's flowering in the 1700s. It started the first in moral theology, the date to retain, and it's not just moral theology, because you see it in the way in which it affects theater. Shakespeare is coming into his own. 1600. 1600, the first volume of a multi-volume a manual of moral theology starts to be written. So if you want to just have something to hang a date on, you could say that Baroque theology starts in the 1600s. And it is a reaction on the part of the church to implement what the Council of Trent wanted to do. So the Council of Trent wanted bishops to stay in their diocese, to work for the reform of their diocese. The model of the Tridentine bishop is Charles Borromeo, where he's dedicated to Milan, and he's dedicated to the needs, spiritual and physical needs of Milan. He's there, and he's trying, for a long time, he was trying to train his clergy. It's one of the few things that two canonized saints get into a big fight over, because Philip Neri feels that he has the vocation to form the future leaders of the church in Rome, and Charles Borromeo steals two of his disciples and takes them to Milan to help reform Milan. And Neri is furious and calls him a thief of souls. But it's all out of this concern to form the clergy. And so the seminary is actually born. What we know as a seminary and the term, the name for it, that all is born of the Baroque. And so then you need to have books that you're going to use to train people to respond to the crises of the day age. And often what happens, if you're responding to someone who's arguing with you, if you continue to argue with them, to resemble the person you're arguing with, because you want to accept as much as you can of their argument to respond. And so the church, in formulating its perspective, swallows a lot of the voluntarist, nominalist perspective, but it gives it an orthodox protection. And we weren't the only ones who did this. If you look in England, if you look at the Anglican, the what emerges from the civil wars in Britain and the Anglican establishment, they do something very parallel to what we do. And so, for example, the natural law, which was, again, rooted in reality and was there to help us live according to reality, in the concrete day-to-day, now just becomes, and you can read this in John Locke, and you can read it in manuals of moral theology, they reveal the will of the lawgiver. So Suarez, for Aquinas, law is a dictate of practical reason in view of the common good by those who have care of the community and promulgate it. So it's a creature of reason that expresses the way things are. For Suarez, the law is an ordinance of the will, expresses the will of the lawgiver. So you're trying to save orthodoxy by having the right authority constraining your will. We'll have a slide that looks a little bit at what that looks like. But so this slide here, the emergence of nominalism, there are no natures, just individual things. We apply collective terms to collections of individuals. This has an enormous influence on poetry. and the way in which the experience of the natural world is expressed. A focus on the individual, not on the general. Individual events, my experience of them. And
again, think about if the natural world has now become a problem for you and you're not sure you understand it as you once thought you did. It's a crisis that you're coming out of. Okay. Actions are only quantifiable, not qualitative. So
just as you're not sure that a deer has a thing called deer nature that it's participating in, because that's one of the things you've lost the idea that things participate in other things. It's hard for you to see that or believe it anymore. Well, then actions are seen in an equally atomized way. One act isn't related to another. It doesn't build on the previous one. It's the radically individual.
And then linked to this, acts, since they have no natures, are good or bad according to the will of the lawgiver. So it doesn't matter.
We can be completely agnostic as to whether that act is according to dog nature, or horse nature, or human nature. But simply, what is God's plan? What is his will? What does he want you to do? And that's expressed in law, and it's expressed through the hierarchy of laws, it's expressed in the scriptures, and you are to get with the program. Now, it's important to realize that for centuries, many of the faithful found this very consoling. If you come from an activist culture,
you're not really concerned about all this speculation. And think about the way in which Baroque theater, the Jesuits, who are the children of the Baroque, one of the communities of the Baroque, they use theater a lot in their evangelization. But what is Baroque theater like? What does Shakespeare say? All the world's a stage. And the Christian life is seen in this dramatic way. Think of Francis Xavier going off to Asia. You have these people that, I don't want to speculate about all this. Just, what's the program? I want to get with it. And I want to share that good news with the world. So these are not speculative minds. These are a generation of practical people, doers. And so you come onto the scene in the theater of life. For a brief moment, you do your noble, extraordinary act that you're called to do, and then you leave. So Francis Xavier goes out to convert the world, and he dies within sight of China, but he's had his brief role on the stage and goes away. This becomes the ideal of Baroque culture. It's not speculating about the nature of things and what does it mean? What are dogs? What are horses? No, it's like, what am I called to do? And there are a few times where they have to confront this, like, are the Indians human beings? And these controversies, it's not by accident that the big people who will be able to help in these controversies don't hold this vision. They hold the older vision about things do have natures, and they appeal to Aquinas to defend the humanity of the Indians. Okay, so
since Baroque theology was the theology of generations of incredible saints, we need to try to have a positive account of how it functioned. And I think one helpful way to look at it is it's like a compression bandage. So if a person in modern warfare, if someone gets radically injured, they'll put a bandage on the injury to stop the bleeding. And it saves the life of the patient. You take them off the battlefield, or you don't. I mean, there are amazing stories of people who, once they've been bandaged up, they stay in the fight. They're no longer dying because the bleeding has been stopped. In some places, they use super glue just to stop the wound. To save the life. Okay, so, but of course, you don't want to go through life with an enormous gaping hole in you. You want to heal the wound. And one of the things that the Baroque did is it separated the life of grace, you study grace in dogma, from the study of moral theology. Just concretely, how did this work? It's made possible by advances in the printing press. So the parish priest working somewhere in Ireland
can order through the mail a volume, a manual of dogmatic theology. And as one famous rector of a seminary in France says, that volume tells you what you have to believe. Then you get the moral theology manual, and that tells you what sins you have to avoid. This is exactly, I'm quoting exactly this the rector of a seminary in Lyon, in France. That volume tells you what you have to, the sins you have to avoid in order to be a good Christian. And then the third volume is actually two volumes. One is on aesthetical theology, and the other is on mystical theology. And this particular rector thinks these are the important volumes. And so aesthetical theology tells you the practices you need to do in order to grow in the Christian life. And mystical theology tells you what God does in your life apart from you. Visions and all these other dramatic things, which were all a part of the great drama, the theodrama of the Baroque. You have saints who are flying around. You have saints who are bilocating. You have Philip Neri was so in love with God that his heart enlarged and it broke ribs and people could see his heart pounding. The Baroque loved this, the theater of God's grace exploding into the world. All right, now, notice the different volumes. So you're a rural parish priest in France, in Ireland. You received a great education, and you preach for the big holy days. You pull out the dogma volume, and you preach on the Trinity. Then, for the quotidian other parts of the year, you preach on moral theology, tell your local farmers and laborers what they have to do in order to go to heaven, in the sense of not sin against the grace in which they've been baptized. And of course, you pull that volume down to help you when you're hearing confessions. And then maybe during the week, if there's a farmer or two who comes to daily mass and you see that they have something of a spiritual life, well, then you'll preach or talk to them using the volumes on aesthetical theology and spiritual theology. So, for example, Kyrie de Ars talks about the farmer who used to sit in church, and he says, well, you know, what do you think about when you're sitting there before the blessed sacrament? Oh, I gaze upon him, and he gazes upon me. Marvelous. So, but this, the Kyrie de Ars is using volumes, the two joint volumes on spiritual theology on that. But notice how everything has been divided up very safely. One way of looking at the Second Vatican Council, which of course is 60 years ago now, is that the Spirit, the good physician, was saying, we have to now take the compression bandage off. It's kept us alive, but we now need to heal the wound. We have to put grace back into moral theology. We have to have moral theology deal with growth in the spiritual life. And dividing the spiritual life between aesthetical and mystical sounds coherent, but what relationship occurs that way? The colloquy of one's relationship with God is a conversation. It's not just me doing all this stuff and then maybe vaguely God's doing this other stuff. No, the causality of God's action in my life, he's the ground. It's like saying, we're going to study roses, but we're not going to study in any way the sense in which the flowering of the rose flows from its very nature and the source of the nature of the rose, God. God is the source of the rose, and the rose bush is the source of the rose. They're together. The activity is together. You can't separate God's causality because he causes the rose bush to exist, and he causes the activity of the rose bush. And so, aesthetical and mystical, you can divide it in thought, but it's lived together.
All right, so looking at the Baroque as a call to remove the bandage. The term moral theology of fairly recent origin starts to be employed in the Renaissance, but it begins to describe a branch of theology in the manuals of the 1600s. Systematic manual divides dogmatic theology, moral theology, aesthetical, mystical theology for different roles, different aspects of an activist church. So to stop the bleeding of a hemorrhaging wound, physicians apply a compressive bandage. Now to heal the wound, what's very interesting too is when you remove a compression bandage, if you keep the compression bandage on too long, you can die of sepsis, blood poisoning.
But if you remove it too soon, you can hemorrhage. But even when you remove it at the right moment, it's painful, and you start to bleed, and subjectively you can think, maybe I'm going to bleed to death.
So the upheavals of the post-council period can be seen as the wounds, the pain of removing the Baroque bandage. Yeah, so I've got that. Removing the compression, a compress is painful, flesh is torn, some bleeding occurs, it can feel like the wound is reopening. The pain is necessary for true healing to occur, for the wounded parts of theology to be put back together. So,
interestingly, as I mentioned how the Anglican divines and the Anglican Church did something parallel, as that world starts to have secular faculties of philosophy and theology, they start earlier than we to figure out that something's wrong in philosophical ethics. Philosophical ethics in Britain in the pre-war years and even after, so in the early 50s, is locked in debates about, is morality about consequences? I should do it because of all the good outcomes it'll have. Or is it about formal rules, impersonal formal rules that I can never, you know, it's like it's a version of a Kantian precept is to always treat everyone as an end and never as a means, or different ways of expressing these formal, exceptionalist norms. But they have no object. It's more formal. Okay. So it's not on individuals, but on categories. So is it rules, formal rules, or is it consequences? And then ethical faculties of ethics in the English-speaking world,
in Britain, in Australia, in America, are locked into this. And it's really a conversation about the source of ought.
Why am I obliged to do something? Now, we started with the question of the regula of the chair. And notice if you start there, the question of ought takes on a different profile. The respecting of the regula, the force of it, is in the outcome. The fact that I have the ability to make a chair flows from that regula. So the regula is expressing something about the way things are. That's its own force. The force comes from the fact, well, if I, living in harmony with that, makes making chairs possible. So the ought comes from the good. And the same is true for plumbing. You know that little loop that's in sinks? You know why that's there? There's several reasons. But you know why that little simple little S loop is there?
The smell.
Very good. Tell me more.
That it prevents the gas coming back up.
Right, because in that little U, there's water always. So it stops the smells and the sewers coming in. Now, that's just a simple little thing. But it's based in the reality of how gases and water work. So it has its own, the force of ought. You know, why do I need to put that S loop in my, well, I mean, if, once you understand the concept, it has its own force. So in a world that believes that things have natures, the source of ought isn't something that you need to worry too much about. You do it because it's the good thing to do. And you develop, like in music, and we'll come to this analogy, you develop your ability to be able to know that that note works there, but another note is flat or sharp or it really sounds terrible. But that note is the right note at the right time in the right place. It's, the Greeks would call it the kalos, the morally beautiful thing. So that the person who figured out that S turn, or I think that was a technical name for this, made an advance that once you see it, you never go back. So it has its own, the nature of things gives it its own source of ought.
But by the time, if you don't believe that things have natures, and if you believe that it's an expression of the will of the lawgiver, but now you no longer believe that there's a lawgiver, well, now you're looking for a source of ought. And they are locked unendingly in battles about whether morality is from rules, formal rules, or whether it's the consequences, the outcomes. Now, what happens?
Miss Anscombe writes an essay in 1955 that is like a hand grenade in the sandbox of moral of ethics, moral ethics, university ethics. And the story is worth telling briefly. She is a Catholic, a convert, married to a Polish-English philosopher, Peter Geech, and she is horrified. She's been very much involved in the Pax Christi movement. She's horrified by the all the wrong lessons seem to have been learned by the Second World War. She was a student at Oxford during the Second World War. She was at St. Hugh's. There's a bunch of other ladies that were at Somerville College, and they were all calling into question the moral relativism of analytic philosophy, people like Bertrand Russell. They believed that there was a difference between good and evil, and you could know it. This group, Iris Murdoch, Elizabeth Anscombe, Mary Midgley, Philippa Foot. So, naively, young Elizabeth Anscombe organizes a protest because Oxford's going to give an honorary doctorate to Harry Truman. And she thinks Harry Truman is a mass murderer, having dropped these atomic bombs on civilian populations. So she wants to gather signatures of her colleagues to protest this. And she can only get like four or five people to sign. So this troubles her. Well, then, Philippa Foot is going to take a fellowship in Canada for a year, and she asks Elizabeth to take over her courses. So she's not a moral philosopher, but she agrees to take over these courses. And she finds in the manuals that they're using for these courses the very logic that was going into justifying the dropping of the atomic bombs. And she finds this very disturbing. So she intensely initiates a study of these manuals, and she writes this essay. And basically the essay is saying,
you folks who are arguing about rules or consequences both share a false understanding of ought. Now, Alistair McIntyre will develop his own kind of analogy for this. It's like when Captain Cook went to Hawaii and saw the different behaviors of the people, and he couldn't understand them all. And Kamehameha, he was very impressed by Kamehameha's reaction and interactions with Kamehameha. And he asked Kamehameha, well, why can't you do X, Y, or Z? And he says, oh, that's taboo. And so then he asked Kamehameha to explain what taboo is. And he couldn't go back any farther. It was just, we don't do that, full stop. And so what Miss Anscombe was basically saying is, ethics in the English-speaking world has developed a notion of ought that functions like taboo. You can no longer justify it because you no longer believe in this. The rules are an expression of the divine will because you no longer believe in God. So you need to return to the question of what makes a human life? What is human nature? What leads to human flourishing? About the same time, Father Pinkers independently is doing something very similar, seeing that we need to go back to an older notion, that his own studies, he did his dissertation on the virtue of hope, that biblical and patristic theology, as expressed in the theological synthesis of Aquinas, developed a vision of Christian life as a call to happiness and fulfillment in Christ as animated by grace of the Holy Spirit and the life of virtue, something that you wouldn't get in the typical volume on moral theology, because moral theology didn't deal with grace, it didn't deal with the gifts. Those were all in different volumes. So he was working to renew moral theology. And that's why I gave you this definition. Moral theology, it's moral, studies human acts, and it's theology, studies God. So it studies human action in relation to God in the light of reason, and that the regula of action that reason can reveal, divine revelation and the regula that the scriptures reveal, but not just the regula, the principles too, the virtues and the gifts and the beatitudes, in order, with the aid of God's grace, his virtues and gifts, to order human acts toward the loving vision of God in the full, as the full happiness and ultimate end of the human person. So the goal of moral theology is now
studying how to live with the aid of grace and the enlightenment that both reason and revelation give us, that journey that leads to the beatific vision.
And we had these groups of virtues. Now, with our last talk, we're going to see how it's instantiated in Catherine of Siena. But I want to look, in the time that I've got left here, how growth in virtue, because Aquinas is very clear that if we're going to understand grace, well, I should back up. There's a famous encounter with Joan of Arc.
So Joan of Arc, she's 16 years old. She basically did the job of the working simple folk of a rural farm community in France, and she suddenly receives this vocation to go tell the Dauphin, so he's the king's son, that he needs to be the king of France and not the English king. If you want to understand all that, you have to go watch Shakespeare and Henry V to understand why the English king has become the king of France. But the Dauphin, who's always terribly portrayed in any Shakespeare play, he was a weakling, kind of cowardly character. She goes and tells him that God wants him to be anointed at Rouen and to take over the kingdom and be the king of France. And it happens. He gets anointed, and he wins battles with her in the battle, but she gets captured. And so the English and their French allies are trying to find a reason to kill her. And they latch on the idea, well, maybe she's a witch and that they were pagan celebrations in her little village. So they spend all this time interviewing the knights who grew up in her region. They're always trying to find all these ways to condemn her. But as they're talking extendedly about life in her village and the festivals that took place in front of her church, out of the blue, the prosecutor, of course, he had to have thought this up the night before. Out of the blue, he says to her, "Are you in the state of grace?" Now, this is a 16-year-old who studied no theology. And the whole conversation is about something else. And she calmly says, "If I'm not, may God place me there. And if I am, may God keep me there." And they say the whole room fell silent. No one had ever expressed the Catholic position as succinctly and beautifully. Now, why do I mention this? Because from the Catholic perspective, we can't have a direct experience of grace. It's like trying to look at yourself and look at your face without a mirror. We have indirect understanding of grace. And so it's by analogy with the natural world that we understand the life of grace. It's by analogy of natural acquired virtue that we understand infused virtue. Because grace is inscrutable. Now, we have given certain signs, the joy we take in doing good, and other things that help us to have a certain confidence that we're in the state of grace. But we don't know. Grace is inscrutable.
So, we turn to analogies, and that's what I want to do with the rest of the time I have. First of all, in this whole call to renewal, we should remember that there are two warring conceptions of practical reason.
One of the things that Aquinas draws from Aristotle is that there are two ways of reasoning. One reasoning is we call speculative reasoning, but it's anyone does it as soon as they know anything. And so speculative reasoning is something that occurs through principles of the intellect, but it doesn't require that I have a well-ordered will. So 2 + 2 = 4. When I have two things, you know, here I've got two things, and I put two things next to these two things, you look at the table, you can see that these two things plus these two things together are four things. And it doesn't matter how angry I am, it doesn't matter how much I would like it to be three things. I can't not see that there are four things here. So I see them. It doesn't matter how I feel about it. I actually might be angry in a certain context, but I can't not see it. So that's speculative reason. But practical reasoning, it does matter how I feel about it. My passions influence my judgment. We desire things. We see things according to our loves when it comes to human action.
So practical reasoning is the product of both intellect and will, knowledge and love. If I have an aversion to Brussels sprouts, I'm not going to spontaneously come to the conclusion that we should have Brussels sprouts for our vegetable at dinner, or God forbid, at breakfast. So that influences practical judgments, my emotions, my passions. So it requires both a virtue in the intellect, prudentia, phronesis, prudence, as well as virtues in my affectivity, justice, courage, and temperance. But from a voluntarist perspective, the intellect is viewed almost like a computer calculator that does its own reasoning, and then I identify myself with my will. I'm free to accept it or reject it as an expression of my freedom. So the dream since Descartes says it very clearly, I want to do for moral philosophy what Galileo did for science. That is, since Galileo thought that the book of nature was written in mathematics, Descartes thinks we should be able to have a kind of mathematical certainty to moral philosophy. But in order to do that, we have to reject the idea that practical reasoning requires well-ordered love. So we have someone, Stuart Hampshire. I mentioned Iris Murdoch. Iris Murdoch said, Stuart Hampshire is very important because he embodies all of the mundane mistakes that are made in philosophy. So he's very good to study because he makes all the most mundane philosophical mistakes. It's kind of a sad way to become of service to philosophy, but there you are. So he says, it is essential to thought that it takes its own forms and follows its own paths without my intervention. Notice, so it's an idea of moral reasoning that doesn't have my intervention. That is, without the intervention of my will. Now, in case we didn't see it, he will go and become explicit. I identify myself with my will. It's what Anthony Kenney will call the little man fallacy, that you've got this computer screen of moral judgment that does its calculus. You know, I put in the info, the reason comes up with its conclusion, and then me, my will, before that conclusion decides whether I'm going to follow it or not. That's the voluntarist understanding of ethics. But for Aquinas, the agent is the one who acts by means of his intellect and will. Acts belong to supposits and to individuals, says Aquinas, as opposed to Stuart, who says very clearly, I identify myself with my will. Now, what does that mean in terms of our relationship to God? This is, again, where someone like John Locke is really helpful because he says it clearly. For John Locke, God is this infinite sovereign who imposes his will on everything. However, he allows us to be infinite sovereigns within a little domain. So the natural law for John Locke tells us what the frontiers of the area where we can be absolute sovereigns. And so you have a tension between God's will and my will, a battle of wills, but God sets the terrain. But for Aquinas, God is the source. Just as God is the source of the nature of the rosebush, and therefore the first cause of the rose, although the rosebush is also 100% the cause of the rose, but secondarily, so to freedom, it's my freedom, acting by intellect and will, but God is the source of it. There's no tension between God's will and my will. Living fully according to my nature is an expression of God's will. And so we've already seen this. I'm going to jump by this because time is pressing. But we already saw the way in which Father Pinkers articulates freedom of indifference and freedom for excellence. And I encourage you, if you don't have a copy of his book, to take a look at these sections, because he spins out, and if you look at, if you take the time to go and hunt down old manuals of moral theology, and some of them, some of the better ones, were translated into English, it does correspond to what the divisions he's articulating, the different aspects of freedom for excellence relationship to freedom for indifference. But I've given you too much information, so I'm going to jump down now to the analogies. And again, since, as Joan of Arc made it clear to us, grace, we know it by analogy with nature, we're going to look at some analogies. Aristotle starts out the ethics by giving us a description of the good. We can't really have a definition of the good, because the good would be in every category that we would use to distinguish. So we have a description of it. And he says here, so it's good is one of the transcendentals. It transcends all categories. Every art and every inquiry, and similarly, every action as well as choice, is held to aim at some good. His analogy is like shooting an arrow at a target. Hence, people have nobly declared that the good is what is that which all things aim. We're aiming to attain the good. But let's look at how we aim to attain the good in skill acquisition. Now, I discovered here we have a few musicians. So you studied piano.
Yeah.
Now, at what age did you start studying piano? So now, how did they ever convince a seven-year-old to study piano?
I was forced.
You were forced?
Well, I think in the early days, yeah.
Yeah, all right. So you were required to do what?
Go to lessons.
And what was lessons primarily focused on?
Teaching the foundations, kind of.
Mm-hmm. So when you were home doing your homework, what were you primarily doing? So a lot of playing of scales?
Yeah, eventually, yeah.
Yeah. So, and before you got as good enough to do scales, you were learning how to put your fingers for different notes and learn to read.
Technique, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, now, but why did you persevere?
My mom made me.
Yes, okay. So you had authority at the beginning, yeah. But you, at some point you kept playing. And why is that?
I think my sister started with me. She was younger and she quit. So then the reason why I kept on it was because I kind of, I learned to enjoy it, kind of.
You learned to enjoy it. Now, hear that. She learned to enjoy it. So she, at the beginning, you weren't enjoying it.
No. Or I don't even remember when I was seven, because I don't know did I want to do it or not. I did a few instruments, but I wanted to play.
Okay, so now when the moment came that you were enjoying it, think back. What were your goals then? Did you want to
pass my grades?
Okay, so you wanted to succeed with your teachers.
Yeah.
But was there any particular piece of music that you wanted to be able to play with ease?
Yeah.
What was that piece of music?
Wow.
So you weren't trying to be Chopin, but okay. In my neck of the woods, a lot of kids wanted to be able to play Linus and Lucy from Charlie Brown Christmas. That was the local, Vince Guaraldi was one of the local geniuses who had funky facial hair and played all over the Bay Area. And he actually dropped dead in Santa Clara playing at the piano on a Saturday morning. Anyway, but notice the features of what you're doing. The one feature McIntyre points out that he gives the example of learning to play chess, that your parents may try to bribe you into playing chess, and you do it because you have to, and then maybe they try to encourage you by bribing you so that if the person plays chess with the adult, they'll get candy, and if they beat the adult, they'll get two pieces of candy. Of course, the kid is just wanting to win and get the candy so that they'll even cheat, but at some point, and you say you started to enjoy it, at some point they start doing what McIntyre says, they start to enjoy the goods internal to the activity. But There are a few things if you identify it, and this is not ideology. You can tell me whether you believe it or not. But someone who perseveres in this skill, there's a standard of excellence. That is, there's someone they want to play like, or there's some piece of music that they've heard that they want to be able to play. So there's a standard of excellence. Vince Guaraldi or Dave Brubeck, although Dave Brubeck was in such another universe, I'm not sure how many people. Well, I guess Clint Eastwood wanted to play like Dave Brubeck. Okay, so you have a standard of excellence. And then you have trust in an expert. It's, at some point as you are learning, you trust the teacher that the teacher knows. As you're doing the scales, for example, you don't actually know how is doing scales ever going to get me playing Linus and Lucy, but you trust the expert because the expert can play Linus and Lucy. All right. And this whole activity of internalizing the rules, playing scales is a way to internalize on a piano the structure, the rules, how you make the notes according to the circle of fifths you can do. So the practice entails a standard of excellence, a trust in an expert, internalization rules, and then the social context of learning, which this is another aspect that's often left out. When a person's learning to play music, often a good music teacher will put it into a social context. So you have a little concert with other people who are at your same level. Or better, you were formed into a little group, a little quartet, a little a group of chamber players, where you perform together. And there's that social context where you all together, basically about the same level, are playing music. Learning a foreign language, same thing. There's a standard of excellence, a native speaker of the language. There is trust in a master, so there's the person who's teaching you the language can speak it, so you trust that they'll be able to help you learn and that they're trained in teaching techniques. And then there are things that you have to do to internalize the rules. You memorize vocabulary, you memorize the grammar, and then the social context. So they'll have a little context where you go and you go to a Parisian cafe in your class and you sit there in class and there's role playing. So the learning of the language is done in such a way that it's put into a limited social context. And then what is the outcome? There's the outcome of being able to play that piece of music. Did you eventually learn how to play it? So that you have a new freedom, the freedom for excellence, the freedom to do something you couldn't do before, the freedom to play that piece of music. Now, again, this is not making you a good person. You can be a fabulous musician and a real jerk. And there are a lot of examples in the history of popular music where we see this. But you, nonetheless, through these five levels, you can become a world-class musician on the Fender guitar or on a Steinway piano. All right. Now, these analogies, that's Mr. Brubeck there, these analogies can help us understand how analogously the Christian life contains these things. So whether it's the social context of setting up a layup in a basketball where you have five people together collaborating to do the beautiful deed, or whether you have a dance, and even better in terms of traditional Irish dance, you've got groups of people dancing together according to the time, and the kalos is to put your foot down at the right moment at the right time in the right way. And then, of course, a jazz quartet is absolutely amazing, or even an octet is even more amazing, where you have people creating music in real time. In Baroque music, it's ornamentation. We have the letters from the parish council, head of the parish council, to Herr Bach, saying, "Herr Bach, we love singing to your music, but could you use less ornamentation when you're playing on the organ? Because the choir is losing the thread of the hymn." Bach liked to create within the framework of the music he had written. All right, so this creativity that becomes possible. The argument here is that the moral life has something similar. Just as the quartet is doing something that has never been done before, that presupposes the internalizing of the rules, but is not reducible to it. So I remember doing a wedding where a Marine officer had never danced, but he had to dance for his wedding, and he wanted to be able to dance to his mother, for his mother-in-law and all the rest. And he was going to dance a waltz. Now, insanely, they chose a Viennese waltz, which is, but anyway, he was going to do it. But he danced as if he was on march. That's not waltzing. You have to internalize the three beats and make it your own. But once you make it your own, you dance in your own way, in your unique way. And so a piece of music, you know, music is not the notes on the page. Music is sound. It's not notes. So it's the person who's playing the music with their own emotion, with their own interpretation. They make that piece of music their own. They have internalized the structure of Western music. It doesn't limit their freedom. And especially when you see improvisers, if they can have a whole conversation within the improvisation, because they'll play a line of a piece of music they know the words to. They can even be having an argument by playing back and forth lines from other songs while they're improvising. And it all sounds beautiful. They can't be counting. It has to be interior. The beat and the standards of jazz have to be second nature. But because they become second nature, they're free to create something new, something that's never been done before. So standard of excellence, the saint, the person of virtue, the trust in an expert. There are people in our lives whose moral judgment we trust. It starts as when we're children. We may have to revise those things, but same as happens with learning an instrument. You go from one teacher to maybe a better teacher. But nonetheless, it requires trust, the internalization of these rules, so that it becomes second nature to live according to the natural law, according to the Ten Commandments. Trent says that grace gives us the ability to live the minimal requirements of charity, which is to not sin against the Ten Commandments. We've internalized the social context. It's with others, in the company of others, that we learn the virtues. And the virtues give us this freedom for excellence. So just as Baroque ornamentation or jazz improvisation, the idea that virtue as a habit limits you to some stereotypic way of behavior is absolutely false. That's not what happens in music, and it's not what happens in the person who has it. You are disposed generically to do the just deed. But what justice requires here and now is radically singular. And it takes the person of virtue to know what they should do here and now. To do as the Greeks say, to do the kalos, the morally beautiful deed, in the kairos, in the critical present moment. So the way it works is that habituation. For as regards those things we must learn how to do, we learn by doing them. For example, by building houses, people become house builders. By playing sitara, they become sitara players. So too, then, by doing just things, we become just. Moderate things, moderate. The word there is sophrosune. So our word, unfortunately, we translate it as temperance. By doing courageous things, we become courageous. Now, in grace, it's according to the economy of merit. So it's not direct as it is on nature. But there's a problem here too. There's an elitism to Greek and Roman virtue morality. For Aristotle, virtue is open to only a few. And virtue is acquired only after a lifetime of practice. So Aristotle will say, most people are, from the hour of their birth, marked off for subjection. That's from the Politics. You know, people talk about Aristotle having a view of natural slaves, but what he means by that is not something like a 20th century, 19th century idea of genes or anything. No, it's they haven't had the education to be able to live the virtues, and so they have to be guided, directed by someone else. That's Aristotle's notion of natural slaves. From the hour of their birth, they're marked off for subjective because they're not furnished an education. And therefore, he will say in the Ethics, it makes no small difference whether we form habits of one kind or of another from our very youth, it makes a very great difference, or rather, all the difference. Now, there's a problem here, because Aristotle can't figure out how someone like St. Augustine, as an adult, can suddenly have a radical conversion. His life becomes completely different. Or for Dubliners, how Matt Talbot can live a life where he literally worked to drink, can on a Saturday morning have such a shocking experience that God's grace is working there too. He stops drinking, never to look back. For Aristotle, Matt Talbot would be the perfect example of someone who is a natural slave. He can't be a man of virtue. And yet Talbot became so radically a man of virtue that when he died, there were missionaries all over the world that thought some wealthy man had died because he was giving all of his salary to promote missionary causes throughout the world. Here's a laborer working on the docks of Dublin. So grace makes possible something that Aristotle could not even have conceived. As Paul will say, God is at work in you, both to will and to do. And then more radically, Paul himself will say, I can do all things in him who strengthens me. And yet this is the same man who says that he had a thorn in his side, and three times he asked the Lord to remove it from him. And what does the Lord say? My virtue, my strength is enough for you, because in weakness, power or virtue is made strong, is brought to perfection. Aquinas looks at this, and he has one of the most personal, self-revealing comments. He said, what a wonderful way of speaking. Power is made perfect in weakness. And then he gives an analogy. Fire grows in water. That's how radical Aquinas sees. How can we say that virtue is perfected in weakness? Something new is going on here. The equivalent of fire growing in water. Now, to kind of summarize what Father Pinkers would argue in terms of the analogies with the arts. He gives the example of learning a piano, learning to play piano, learning a foreign language. You have natural disposition rooted. Freedom is rooted in the natural inclination of the will towards the truth, the true and the good, and the intellect's natural knowledge of it. Discipline, you have to practice according to the rules. You internalize them, therefore the acquisition of acquired virtue, the disposition to produce at will and as a matter of creative choice, works of beauty and perfection. So the person can play Linus and Lucy whenever he wants, however he wants. Guaraldi himself, when they did the recording, and of course I think what they do is they put the animation on the screen and he plays to it, but he did his own improvisation, and the improvisation became so standard that when someone like George Winston wanted to do an album celebrating Vince Guaraldi, he says, I had to transcribe all of the improvisations because they had become what everyone thought the song was. That had never been written down. They were just Guaraldi's improvisation when he went into the studio playing his own music. And when he tried to play what was written and do his own improvisation, no one liked it. It didn't sound as good. So he then had to transcribe the improvisation. And as a friend of mine said, what is written music? It's simply improvisation written down. Someone had to think up that sound for the first time. Okay, so this creative freedom. And the goal is to be able to do this in a way that is expression of excellence, whether in the arts or in the moral life. Now, stages of growth is very interesting. We'll end, I'm going to give you some biblical quotes, but we'll end with this in terms of the analytical part. There were lots of discussions about stages of growth. You had John Climacus, who had identified many stages, and Aquinas unhesitatingly says that stages in the growth of charity. Charity is what growth is all about. A person grows close to God through charity. But there are levels that correspond to the ages, the natural ages of life. And of course, it's interesting. There's no adolescence in this vision. There's childhood up until puberty. And then with puberty, there's adulthood. And then the next stage, actually, I'm sorry, there's childhood until the age of reason. So that's childhood. Then from the age of reason until puberty, there is that growth. And then at puberty, there is adulthood. And he says, well, if that's the natural stages, there's something like that in grace. There's the stage of beginners, where they primarily, like in music, they primarily have to learn how to not break the rules. So the Ten Commandments are the primary focus. It's the stage of the beginners, the predominance of faith. They have to trust that this way of living is actually going to lead to their happiness. And it's what the Carmelites, it's actually also part of the Franciscan way, will talk about the purgative way. But it's the way of the incipientes, the stage of beginners. And then progress. The focus is no longer the Ten Commandments, but on the Sermon on the Mount, the stage of those who are making progress, the proficient, proficientes. Here, hope predominates. Hope is the virtue of those on the way. And the Carmelites will describe this as the illuminative way. And then maturity, life in the Spirit, friendship with God, the stage of the perfect, the prominent predominance here is charity, where we love what God loves. Our primary focus is loving what God loves, doing what God would want us to do, participating in Christ's vocation, so the mystery of the cross, and therefore the unitive way. Now, if we look at this scripturally, I just want to give you two quotations. Romans 5, 1 through 5 is a masterpiece. You know, after the Reformation, Dominicans used to memorize the entire letter to the Romans. But memorizing just these five verses wouldn't be a bad idea, because you have the Trinity, you have the theological virtues, you have grace. They're all there. Therefore, having been justified by faith, that is, being put into right relationship with God by faith, we have peace with God. God there being God the Father, through our Lord Jesus Christ, the Son, through whom also we have access by faith into this grace in which we stand. And we rejoice in hope, hope directed towards the glory of God. So you've actually got grace and glory. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulations produce perseverance. Now this word here, perseverance, patient endurance, it's hupomone, it's the primary Greek act proper to courage. The Aristotle says, you know, courage is, the two acts of courage are to attack and then to bear attacks. And he says, well, which is more primary, to attack for a soldier, or is it to bear the blows on your shield? And he says, no, that's more, courage is more about enduring the blows. So perseverance, proven character, hope. Now, hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out into our hearts by the Holy Spirit. So hope is able to hope because we're already united to God in love, because the Holy Spirit has been poured into our hearts. We don't have time to go into this in detail, but you might on your own want to read 2 Peter 1, 3 through 8. Where it introduces, this is the youngest letter of the scriptures, it introduces the notion that we have been given the vocation to participate in the divine nature. And it comes up with its own list of virtues. Talks about God's virtue through the knowledge of Him who calls us by His own glory and virtue. The promise we've received to share in the divine nature, to be koinonoi, that's the language of friendship. Those who have koinonia can become friends. Koinonia in the divine nature. And so it says here, for this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue. Now, Greek had no way to do a parentheses. to supplement your faith with virtue, then it gives us a list of virtues that end with love. So if it had a parenthesis, I think we could restructure it this way. Supplement your faith with virtue, because it goes on to say, it reduplicates to have the equivalent of a parenthesis. Virtue with knowledge, gnosis. Knowledge with self-mastery, enkrateia. So if patient endurance is the primary act of courage, enkrateia is the primary act of temperance among the Greeks. So your knowledge with self-mastery, self-mastery with patient endurance, so hupomone, patient endurance with reverence. Now we'll come back to that, eusebeia, and then reverence with mutual affection, Philadelphia. So the affection, the friendship you should have for the Christians, the household of Christians, and then that with love. So if you look at this, what you've got is you've got the traditional four cardinal virtues re-expressed that begin with faith and end with love. Self-mastery is the primary act of temperance, of sophrosune for the Greeks. So it's in that appetite that desires. Patient endurance is the primary act of courage, and it's in that irascible appetite. And then reverence. What is reverence? This eusebe is translated as piety, pietas, which is one of those words, again, that needs to be sent to the cleaners. We have a vestige of it in filial piety. But most of the time when you hear filial piety, you think of Asian culture. What is filial piety?
To do with brotherly love.
Actually, it has to do with your relationship to your parents. How you have reverence, how the children have to have reverence for their parents. And it has a whole series of things, activities that you're called to do that are owed to your parents as parents. Well, so pietas, eusebeia in Greek, is what we owe to all of creation and all of our relationships. It's a form of justice, but it's a religious justice. So I think reverence is the better word for it. And so he's, instead of using the very charged word dikaiosune, which he's already used to talk about how we've been justified, he puts reverence there. And then mutual affection, Philadelphia is the friendship we should have for fellow Christians, and all of this is love. So it begins with faith, and love is the bookend. And if you have any doubts about that's how it should be interpreted, Ignatius of Antioch does exactly that in his list of virtues. He starts with faith, gives a list of virtues, and then has it be animated by charity. So this is a vision to say all the traditional virtues begin for the Christian, you live them in faith, and they're animated by charity. If you carefully peer into them, you will be able to be built up in the faith that was given to you. This faith is the mother of us all, with hope following close after, and love of God, Christ, and neighbor leading the way. For anyone centered on these has fulfilled the commandments of justice. There again, the justice being that deeper sense of justice. Ignatius, if you want to understand biblical virtue, Ignatius is marvelous because he's close to it. Anyway, we're getting close to the end here. I will have us end with, here's another one that has. Yeah, here's the one I was wanted to point you to. This is the beginning and end of life. Arche telos. Faith is the beginning. Love is the end. And the two together in unity are God. All their things that lead to nobility of character. Kylo, kalathos. So it's kalos and agathia. Follow. So the virtues begin in faith and are brought to completion in charity. Our help is in the name of the Lord.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.